Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour. Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. I'm Adnan Hussein, director of the project, and your host. It has been a while since our last episode, and it would be no exaggeration to say that much has happened over the last several months. As we enter 2024, it seems we could all use some beauty and joy in our lives, in our world. So I'm really excited about today's conversation, which will focus on the Arabic musical instrument, the oud, and its fascinating history with Dr. Rachel Beckles Wilson, who is the author of a wonderful and beautiful new book, The Oud, An Illustrated History, published by Interlink Books. But before I introduce her properly and we begin discussion of this important new work, for listeners who aren't familiar with this instrument, I want to play a brief clip of my favorite oud player, the late Hamza El-Din, a Nubian musician from Upper Egypt. Take a listen to this excerpt from the song Greetings from his album, A Wish. Hope you enjoyed that. Well, I'm delighted that Rachel Beckles Wilson joins us today to discuss her recent work on the oud, an illustrated history. It's hot off the press, and I'm very excited to talk about this fascinating topic, subject, and book with her. She is professor of intercultural performing arts at Codarts University of the Arts in Rotterdam, and also the Academy of Creative and Performing Arts at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And she's an award-winning and internationally sought-after scholar, multi-instrumentalist and composer. She plays a number of instruments, including the oud in Arab, Iranian, and Turkish traditions. And she's been involved for more than a decade on research in Middle Eastern music, which has led to publications ranging across topics like Orientalism and Musical Mission, Palestine and the West, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2013. And she has an online resource that listeners, you may want to check out called Oud Migrations, www.oudmigrations.com. And she's her publications before this magnificent book were in shape of articles on the topic of the oud, and that led to her winning the Francis Densmore Prize of the American Musical Instrument Society in 2021.
So, Rachel, it's really an honor and a pleasure to have you on the Mudgeless. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Adnan. It's a lovely invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very excited as somebody who has loved the oud for, I don't know, 30 years or more, but never learned to play, and I'm just starting now to engage with the instrument. It's very exciting that this book has come out and that we have a chance to learn a lot more about this fascinating instrument and its incredibly long history. Before we get started, though, on the subject of that history, I just wanted to ask you about how you came across the oud. What's your connection to it, and what's the context in which you began to explore the oud as an instrument and take an interest in its history?
Yes, so unlike you, I haven't known about the oud for decades. I grew up in London, and I was trained as a classical pianist, and I also played saxophone. And I then took an academic turn and started doing research in contemporary music. I had been studying in Hungary, so that was the kind of direction I took it initially. But I became interested in a phenomenon I was reading about in the British press, which was the European interest in investing in Arab communities through Western classical music. And this I found extremely provocative in terms of the way it was being discussed. So there was some very, very colonial kind of imperialist discourses that were being presented, even in the quite left-wing press, about kind of giving the Arabs culture. And I thought, this needs really dismantling. And yeah. So I initiated a research project, and I found myself focusing increasingly, rather than on a kind of broad Arab world study, on the situation in occupied Palestine and inside Israel. And through that research, which culminated in the book that you mentioned, Orientalism and Musical Mission, just through that process of going regularly to Jerusalem and Jericho, Nablus, Jenin, Bethlehem, all these places, I encountered the oud. And it was through one of my initial contacts, who's an oud player called Nizar Rohana, that I discovered the number of different ouds around. So it's not just that there is an oud, and that has been made in the same way for forever, and that it's the same size and it's the same style. No, there are hundreds of thousands of ouds, and if they're not factory made, then they certainly all have a different voice. And of course, they have their different historical stories. So I was captivated by the sound, and I was captivated also by the diversity of sounds and shapes. Ouds are so beautiful to look at and extraordinary to hear if you're not familiar with that sound world. And the sort of broader context for this was a very disturbing piece of research for me, which was my exposure to the Palestinian situation and my discovery of the historical role of the Brits in particular there, but also the Germans and the French. And so the whole of Europe and also parts of North America was deeply entangled with the situation that is so very, very painful there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's something that maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the oud and lament and the situation in the region. I wanted to ask you, so what did you really want to accomplish in the book, and why the kind of book that you wrote? This is maybe something of a departure from your two previous major monographs that are very kind of academic and about the cultural history, you know, Cold War, you know, Hungarian music in the Cold War, and this one about kind of Orientalism and the role of music in the missionary kind of mission civilatrice, you know, although that's not what the British called it, but the civilizing, you know, mission in Palestine. You know, what were your ambitions with this book? That is a gorgeous book with so many beautiful pictures and illustrated history, but also one that covers such a span and canvas. It's not a focused study of the oud and modern Arab music, for example. It's this really capacious kind of work. So what were you trying to accomplish, and why did you decide to write this book, and particularly the way you decided to approach it?
I was very fortunate that the project was a collaboration with a publisher. So if we just wind back a little to, let's say, 2015, I was very fortunate to receive a major research grant from the Leverhulme Trust, which enabled me to really explore many facets of the oud in terms of making, in terms of performance traditions. I was able to travel, I was able to meet a lot of people. And one output of that was the website you mentioned, my project Oud Migrations, in which I not only put my own research, but I give a space for different types of knowledge. For example, luthiers and performers are able to put their words there. So that was one result of that research. Some others were some scholarly articles. And in the meantime, I did meet the founder and editor of Interlink Publishing, Michel Mushabek. So we actually played together. Michel also plays Arabic percussion. And he said several times that he would very much like an oud book from me, and that it could go in various directions, but what he would really like is a highly illustrated book. I shelved the project for many years because it didn't really fit with the kind of work I needed to do for my professorial work. And I somehow couldn't really find the inspiration. The change came partly with distance and time. Time passed, and then we had a pandemic and I was at home. And I needed a project. And I started to think, actually, I should write that oud book. And so I dropped the publisher line and said, are you interested? Yes, we're interested. Send some draft chapters, send your outline. So I spent some time getting the voice I wanted. So I was, as you say, writing a very different type of book. I didn't want it to sound academic. I knew I would need to initially find the right tone to storytell. On the other hand, I also needed to be backing up all my information, so I had my whole scholarly apparatus. And after I drafted out a few chapters, I sent it off. And I was very happy that Interlink Publishing was very keen to take this on. And so then I started working on the rest. I called it at that stage a cultural history. But Michel, the publisher, was very keen that it should reach as many people as possible and should show the beauty of the oud, so captivate potential readers that way. And so then during the later stages of the book production, I was able to add more and more images. Because coming from the academic world, in which I'm used to sort of saying, oh, I need a couple of images, and everybody turns pale and says, oh, that's going to cost.
Right.
I hope they're going to be black and white, or we can only do black and white. So I moved into a space in which every time I send something, this, yes, but we need more images. And it was absolutely my responsibility to provide the images, which was the most colossal amount of work. But I was supported by the design team of Interlink, and by the end it was a collaboration, and that's a very joyful experience for me as a writer. I've never had that experience of seeing my words turn into an experience, if you like. I think for me it was also an absolute triumph to be able to tell stories without having to write anything. So just being able to put the pictures there shows that happened.
Yes. Well, I mean, one thing that you can, there is a clear sort of thread or narrative that you can follow, or arguments by just looking at these beautiful photographs and noticing changes in what ouds look like in the modern period where we have examples, or even looking at the drawings and how they are depicted in previous eras, and where these ouds are located, which you also make part of the story. So I think it definitely was a very fruitful, maybe something that, a timpani or something, I don't know if there's a good musical, I think Edward Said talked about, he had a particular term he liked, I'm forgetting it at the moment, but for kind of two different voices, yeah, maybe counterpoint, I think that might have been, but I think it was a very wonderful visual counterpoint to the text that you provided in each of these chapters. So it sounds like the goal was to try and bring some appreciation for the beauty of the oud, the history of the oud, to a broader audience. Go ahead.
I guess I could add, it's also, it's the shape of the book and the what might seem an eccentric way to tell history. So a book in 40 short chapters. This is also part of one of my fundamental aims, which is to tell multiple stories, to tell multiple histories. Because as is quite typical, topics and objects tend to get normalized into one standard narrative that is carried by certain people. And what I wanted to show is that there's much more. So the images enabled me to do that, for example, to show so many vintage images of women playing the oud. Mm-hmm. The multiple chapters enabled me to just look at different angles and point up connections without necessarily saying that one caused the other, but taking a certain topic and then exploring that and then stepping back again was a way to enrich the mainstream narrative of the oud and to point out its enormous complexity. I mean, we call something the oud, we've called it for centuries in loads of countries, but it's not the same thing in all those places and in all those times. So how can you tell one story?
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll get a chance to explore some of the interesting dimensions of exactly that complexity. But why don't we start at the beginning? Because, a good history book starts with origins, but I love the way it's not actually kind of captured as the necessary origin for the stories you tell, but it's a wonderfully evocative kind of legend. You tell us a little bit about the traditional legend about the origins of the oud in a kind of biblical genealogy. Maybe you could tell us that story about Lamech and what you did with it and how you connect the emergence of lament, that music in some ways is framed as having its origin as well as the instrument, the oud, in lament and in grief, in mourning, and how you connect that maybe as a theme to a thread that runs through the book at certain times, but also very much in the contemporary Middle East.
Sure. So one of the joys, I think, of writing for the general public is the literary license and the literary potential you have. So I felt much freer. So yes, I start the book with a legend, which is a very beautiful kind of symbol, I think. It's according to this story, Lamech, a man who was descended from Adam, descended from Cain, son of Adam, lost his son. His young son. So he lost a child in his life. And then he, in order to somehow reflect on his grief, he hung up the carcass of his son and said that I will stay with this, I will watch it until it's gone. But what actually happened is then when the bones were left, he took it down and made a musical instrument from it. and he played it and wept. And this was ostensibly the first lament. And so it's a story of the most intense grief, which is somehow transformed into something that releases emotions and then gives space for the new. And I felt that this had something to do with my own life. We all have personal stories, and I have my own share, and I've often used music to reflect on those and to help me with painful situations. And today we see this is a social thing that is happening, certainly in Europe and North America. And on occasion, the oud is closely entangled. One of the examples I give in the book is the case of Nasir Shammah's work, which is a very painful reflection on the bombing by the Americans of Iraq. And he, through his piece, he actually recreates the sound of the bombing and the song of the children. So this is very painful, but somehow through the pain one can find some consolation perhaps. And I've been asked whether I think the oud is particularly good at this, and I would say probably no. It's just that the oud is so connected to stories of loss and stories in the modern era of colonialism, that it's particularly apt to listen to think about the oud in this context. But I think that perhaps there are instruments or even the human voice that are more apt for communicating certain types of emotion, because the oud in the end is a percussive box. Mm-hmm. It's melodic, but it's a struck instrument. It struggles to really emulate the human voice, the core of kind of human expression.
Well, I just one example that I also recall you mentioning is the significance, at least for you, in noting it, the oud piece developed and played in the Grenfell Tower memorial that took place, I believe you mentioned, in St. Paul's Cathedral, and was meant to be a kind of medley of different national or cultural music representing the identities of the diverse array of victims from all over different parts of the world in that horrible fire. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that, the significance of that.
Yes, so the case of Grenfell Tower is a case of enormous the class divide of British society, corporate neglect, exploitation, and many hard up people lost their lives and their homes, and justice has not been done. In the kind of gap between the cruelty and the justice, there are spaces of coming together and mourning, and that was one of them. There was a service at St. Paul's Cathedral. And the Syrian oud player Rihab Azar, who lives in London, did play, and it was a beautiful moment. In that period, it was also appropriate to have a Syrian playing the oud, I think, and particularly powerful to have a woman, mm-hmm. because the oud has been so associated with men.
Well, that's something that we should, that's an important theme. And I think in one of the important contributions of the book is to bring these different cultural histories and who participated, who played, and how that has changed. You mention, and you provide some in this early history from archaeological and artistic evidence to illustrate the fact that early playing was mostly women. So perhaps you can tell us about that kind of early period and then how and why that has changed. But it is fascinating, both because women have been associated with traditions of lament, lamentation, but also entertainment. And so maybe you can also, I mean, these are these two different parts of the history and story of the oud, like, you know, all music, that there may be a lament, a sad grief, mourning, but then there's this entertainment component. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about the development of the oud and its gendering, the gender history of the oud.
Yes, it's another area where multiple histories are needed, but and many of them are slightly speculative. So we have some images, for example, we have some extraordinary carvings from the first or second century from Central Asia, what is now Afghanistan and Pakistan, which show female players of an oud-shaped instrument. The teardrop shape or the pear shape is there in the hands of women. And these are kind of, these are very hybrid cultures in that space at that time. They're Greco-Hellenic, they're sort of Hellenic Buddhist, but we're really, scholars don't necessarily agree on exactly what the cultures were, and they were blended with all sorts of different tribes and influences. But it seems there that the oud was a part of a celebratory, even Dionysiac kind of space. Later on, the oud was developed in the Persian courts, and there we have more concrete evidence of the role of the instrument in the court space. So it seems as a there's a transfer of music worshipping the gods to music worshipping a royal figure, a man. And from that time on, in the kind of there's a literary history that one can trace, which is full of holes and is anecdotal and is literary. It doesn't fulfill the criteria of modern historians, but you trace spaces in the court where there are enormous numbers of women playing in almost sort of choirs of ouds, and they are in the service of the rulers. Their status is generally enslavement, but that had a certain type of security. Not all of them had the possibility to learn music, but those who did had it as one of their many skills. They were singing, they were writing poetry, and they were providing the court entertainment. In that era and in the Abbasid era, a little later, the Arab courts of Baghdad and Kufa and then in Southern Europe, it's difficult to know what was going on outside the court spaces, of course, because we don't have the records. So was this music also played on the street? Were these instruments available outside these spaces? We don't know exactly. But during the Abbasid period, there was a shift, and the oud, I think, for some time kind of lost its gendered role as men started to play it. And there are some male names that appear in the literature from the 9th century onwards who have clearly had positions of power and have had their own slaves, female slaves. So they were musicians, they were slaves themselves, but they had other slaves under them. And there's a shift. And then at some time after that, it seems to have become more common for men to be playing. And yet at the same time, there are these other stories where the oud, having come to Europe and being taken up by Spanish, the Italians, and then the Germans, and the English, it had a particular role, as by then called the lute, in Venice, for example, where women were not allowed to work except with the profession of procuress or courtesan. And one of the ways that they could earn money to pay their taxes was to provide entertainment, musical and sexual, for male clients. And this was a profession that was tolerated because these women were tax payers. taxpayers, sorry, oud playing taxpayers. Some of them were, they left a collection of instruments when they passed away, and we have their records. And in my book, I really relish being able to name certain courtesans and also to name various female slaves in the Abbasid court, in order to point out that these are individual women whose lives were, they were contributing to the fabric of the urban spaces where they lived, but they were also individuals, and I tell some of their stories of struggle, and some of them are quite exciting.
Well, yes, go ahead, yeah.
And then just to sort of go forward yet further, then in the 19th century, I think perhaps we don't really have the records, but the records we have are of male players, for example, in Egypt, and male players arriving at the Ottoman court from Egypt, and the Ottoman court employing male musicians. It seems that women were playing the oud in this period, but perhaps in domestic environments. And they certainly, Muslim women were not allowed to record, and they were not allowed to perform. So the women who did record tended to be of Roma extraction or Greek. So there's another story there of intersecting identities and intersecting opportunities. And so when I turned to the oud as a woman, there were very few models, because that tendency of it being a male instrument, and people saying it is a male instrument, has continued. And I studied always with men until actually during lockdown, when I started studying with a female teacher in Iran. It's changing. So we are entering an era now where more and more women are learning the oud. It's changing, but there is still a very strong view that this is a male instrument.
Right. I mean, but even in modern times, there are some of the great paragons of Arabic music singing. People like, you know, Kulthum, the famous Egyptian artist, was known to play the oud, and she knew how to play the oud. There are some evidence of her holding an oud, playing an oud. She didn't necessarily do it in her large public performances. So there is something about the public kind of characterization that's very important here. And obviously the remote history of some of the song women of the Abbasid courts and later court culture, almost courtesan style in the Middle East as well, are very remote from people's memory. And of course, that's not also the most edifying kind of context in which, modern women to be playing the oud is in the historical memory of, slave song girls and so forth. So that seems like the gendering, it's almost in some ways got worse in the more modern period, and that there were maybe more possibilities for women's public music playing and oud playing in particular in prior eras of history, which is fascinating to kind of think of in some ways. But getting back to that kind of early kind of gendered and cultural history, it seems that there was also a tension that you bring out and you discuss and talk about, is that some of the transition to men becoming oud players around that time in the Abbasid era seems also somewhat connected to reformist cultural trends that saw dangers in music itself, and also in the enticing and provocative challenge to men that women playing music in a public environment might pose. And so one of the very famous treatises by Al-Jahiz is a treatise on song girls. And as you point out in your book that it's these are always funny, humorous, interesting stories, and he's documenting this whole culture, but he's also using it to edify the reader that there are some real dangers of seduction here. And, you know, if you are captivated by the charms of the song girls and their music, you know, you might lose your money and go bankrupt and just get so absorbed in these unproductive activities that you'll lose your social status. So there are tensions, and that's, he's not a particularly, you know, kind of he's not a figure who's a representative of a narrow conservative religious elite. He's, you know, somebody who's connected with the court culture. But there is also, of course, the religious prohibitions or warnings about, you know, the, I guess you would call it the hedonistic culture of the courts that they see as a danger and not good examples for pious Muslim leadership of the community that also have to be accounted for. How did this kind of play a role perhaps in shifting opening it up for men to become oud players in a kind of public way, so that we hear about some of these people like Ziryab and so on, and that you tell us even, you know, it's clear with some research afterwards that perhaps it still were women whom he employed who were maybe writing many of the songs that he's credited with and acclaimed for. So there's an interesting shift taking place where it's acceptable for men, but they're also now being lionized and getting credit for things that perhaps they're not really the principal cultural producers of.
Yes, I mean, you're inviting me to speculate because I don't really have access to the information that would tell me how that change happened. But I do recognize this enormous anxiety that you're talking about that's coming in the discourse about the correct behavior for Muslim men, and in particular the leaders. And I think perhaps women have been very unfortunate in that there was genuine concern that leaders were not showing the correct model for society. And in that sense, nothing has changed. Look where we are now. So one of the things that the leaders were doing that was seen as so problematic was having very, very lavish parties with goodness knows what types of debauched entertainment. And rather than criticizing them directly, they pointed to the kind of temptations that lay around and how those had to be put out of sight. And so women were sort of treated as the problem, whereas the problem wasn't the women, as it isn't today either. So the kinds of, yes, it's very sad that this tendency still continues, that, you know, women who are attacked are often seen as in some way culpable. Yeah, there's a problem. You can see it in quite extraordinary ways in some of the reports in the Abbasid Times of men indulging in even the music of women as if it's a kind of guilty pleasure. Mm-hmm. So that the woman is locked away somewhere and you know, they pass through door after door, and then finally they can listen to the woman through the final door without opening the door and actually seeing her. Or women were playing behind curtains. So that there's a sense that, yes, music should be valued and appreciated, but so long as the body of the woman is not actually visible. I think later on you get this sense that the role of the woman is to be in the home and to nurture the family, and to do that enormous unpaid labor for the whole society. And that's certainly the case in Europe at certain moments when This was seen as a need to have somebody in the home looking after the family, and therefore it was assumed that that should be the women, and therefore they cannot work in the public sphere because that would be a threat to society if that figure wasn't in the home. So that's something else that goes on and was happened in Europe. And it comes and going waves, comes and goes in waves, that idea, of course, of
Yes, and I mean, I think the book also showed that there were similar kinds of tensions around the courtesan culture that you were talking about before with lute playing. And that just reminds me that one of the things I wanted to talk about, obviously I'm a medieval historian, so I'm spending maybe more time than warranted in this pre-modern period because it's so fascinating to me. But before we start coming, you know, to the more modern iterations of the oud and its cultural history, I just did want to talk a little bit with you about the fact that there are so many parallels between principally Southern European and Middle Eastern musical cultures, and the oud seems to be a way to think about kind of a Mediterranean world of music. And of course, then has its resonances further north. But how do you characterize this big encounter and the kind of relationship between the lute and the oud in the cultural history? Because you include quite a lot of discussion actually about the lute as part of this history of the oud. So how do you kind of make sense of what has sometimes been a kind of contentious narrative of borrowing, you know, what influenced what, which aren't always the most productive ways to think about it. But how are you sort of framing this kind of encounter that the oud illustrates?
I think as a historian, I'm always fascinated by the underdog. So I'm fascinated by what's going on at the edges. And it's extremely difficult to find the traces of that, notoriously, especially in the period of encounter that you're talking about, the ninth century. Essentially, all we have is this kind of, we have images. So we can see the mixing. We have the roof painting of the Cappella Palatina in Palermo, which shows this incredible complexity and diversity of iconography being practiced by the Arab painters there and carvers. And what for me is very sad is that after that time, the European, the rise of European colonialism and power meant that all this kind of history was denied. And there's a construction of Europe that is completely false and artificial. And so the lute becomes the lute without any reference to why it's called lute even, or where it comes from, or what it's still having a parallel history with. So one of the things I like to look at is the parallel development of the oud and the lute in terms of each of them getting more strings, even though those two traditions aren't in courtly terms or very officially talking to each other. There are sort of parallel movements in the development of the two instruments, and these remind us that there were people traveling the world, and yes. You know, humans make transformations and developments wherever they are, and sometimes two quite similar stories happening in very different places. So I wanted to point that out. And as you said at the opening of our conversation, this is a very broad book. I was synthesizing a lot of research by other writers, and where the research hasn't been done in many cases, I couldn't say very much. Or I didn't have the scope to sort of spend another 3 years looking at a corner where I felt I didn't know enough, because that would have been most corners. Ultimately, it's a very wide ranging book. So that encounter sort of what followed that time of encounter in which the Mediterranean was really sort of exchanging a lot of different types of knowledge and experience was the closure. I think in the last 50 years, there's been very gentle attempts to revitalize connections through music specifically. So there have been some recording projects initiated in Spain with encounters with North African musicians, for example, to try to kind of recover a lost connection, a lost history. And what the musicians involved find is that the traditions are, because of the way European music has developed into harmony and very particular types of fixed performance practice, kind of a reproductive performance practice, finding compatibility with the traditions is a big challenge, and it can be a fantastic creative challenge if you embrace it. But in particular, I think the Europeans can feel quite inadequate because they cannot actually spontaneously make music quite often in response to what other people are doing. And they cannot necessarily improvise. They cannot necessarily listen and play what they've just heard. So the potential for real collaboration when you're used to reproducing a very particular tradition is quite narrow. So it's taken many attempts, and they've been happening all over the place. And in the same period, and sort of since the 80s, there have been the rise of this popular category in music marketing, world music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another space in which, of course, there is an attempt to cross things over. In that popular sphere, there tends to be quite a lot of influence of pop music, of rock music. So it's that brings its own baggage. That brings its own demands.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I don't know very much about music to be able to appreciate in specifics what you're really talking about in terms of the difference in how Western music has developed with these fixed canon or fixed musical text that has to be reproduced, rather than this perhaps more improvisational kind of approach. But it does seem that there are very significant differences in these streams as they begin to develop, which is maybe part of the reason why there's so much melodic variety in the kind of Eastern musical tradition. But I wonder also, did this affect the oud's history? Could you just play different kinds of repertoires on a similar, basically similar instrument, or did it affect how the oud develops? You mentioned something about a parallel development of adding what I guess was about a fifth string and sometimes even a sixth course of strings. And if I understand correctly, the early history seems to be dominated more by a four string pattern that could then also have all kinds of wonderful cosmological, resonances with the different elements and different humors. And so, like so much of early science or scientific thinking, these are very integrated, where cosmology and the body and, the sciences are all very integrated with one another. But that they, at that time, still had the possibility and knew about adding a fifth string. So maybe this is a good moment to hear a little bit more about the oud as an instrument, how it's kind of constructed and what the basic pattern and how that has evolved, and whether that has anything to do with the continued, relevance of the oud in Arabic tradition, and the fact that the lute is really not a very, it doesn't have a history that goes a lot, goes forward in quite the same way that the oud in the Arabic tradition does. I don't know if that makes sense as a question, but maybe we can talk. We haven't actually talked about the oud as an instrument, what it's like. And you'd be a great person, since a lot of the book talks about these kinds of topics, as well as oud construction and changes in it, in construction techniques and approaches.
Yes. Yeah, so it seems that the word originally is of two, well, not originally, certainly, but from our earliest evidence, we can trace two different types of oud model. And one of them was made in a single piece of wood so that the neck was actually attached to the curved body. But later, ouds, and that's the model we know today, there was a body which was constructed with strips of wood, probably stretched and bent over a mold, and a separate stick was placed onto it and secured in order to make the neck. And strings were stretched over between a box for pegs to which the strings could be attached to a bridge on the face of the instrument, so on the front. And by plucking the strings, you make the very thin piece of wood that's on the front of the instrument, you make that vibrate, and the air inside it vibrates. So kind of amplify the sound of the string. More recently, there's been another shift, which is to attach the strings to the base of the instrument itself and to have what's called a mobile bridge or a floating bridge, which is more like a violin or a cello. And this has a different way of transferring the vibrating string energy to the vibrating front energy and then the air in the instrument. So it has a different resonance. It tends to be louder. As you say, Adnan, it is the early oud seems to have had four strings, and I would say that still four strings are the core of the oud, or four double strings, so mm-hmm. Say four courses. And typically there are two lower courses, which are more like resonance providers. These originally, I think, were not played melodically, and some of them, it seems from early instruments we have, were actually not even aligned properly with the neck, so that they were slightly outside the neck or the stick, the fingerboard we call it, so that you couldn't actually change the pitch of them except by pulling the tension tighter. But these days they are aligned carefully so that you can press them down on by touching the neck and therefore shorten the string and change the pitch. So the range of the oud in terms of its melodic potential has certainly increased a lot. And now people play right from the bottom string, the lowest pitch, as a melody, and they go also right, they press down right on the face of the instrument at the top to play very, very high as well. And so this has transformed the instrument from being more of an accompanying instrument that is played with the voice into a vehicle for virtuosic display, often solistic display. And that is, of course, a strong influence of Western commercial Western, I would say initially classical, and then kind of more commercial musical developments of soloists such as the violinist Paganini or the pianist Liszt in the classical world, who turned their instruments into vehicles for extraordinary physical display. In terms of the lute, yes, the lute was gradually replaced by keyboard instruments. So in a sense, it's European industrialization that put the lute to sleep for many, many years. And although it's had a comeback, it is in a specific sphere, yes, of playing historical repertoire only sort of up to the 18th century.
Period piece, sort of like early music and so
absolutely.
Forth. Well, it seems like there's a lot of variety and changes that have taken place in the oud. So when you said that, there isn't one history to the oud, You also dedicated some time to, in the modern period, different traditions of oud design and making and how they fit into the particular musical preferences or cultures of those societies, from Turkish ouds, Balkan kind of styles, to, you know, the kind of Levantine and Egyptian sort of world, and then Iraq. I was fascinated by, you know, some of the design changes that you mentioned about this floating bridge seem to be associated with Iraq. And it seems to have developed its own very independent outside of the rest of the Arab world, actually. That's kind of interesting and fascinating. How and why that happened, and what's the consequence of that? You mentioned one thing is that it's louder, but what do you, how do you reflect on the reasons why, or what the resonances are of some of these changes in the modern world, in these national traditions? How do those arise, and what happens in the change, you might say, from the early modern courtly traditions that still are sort of connected with that long history of the oud as a, you know, instrument that is played at a court for entertainment, you know, of the sovereigns or in the wealthy patrons and so on, to this kind of changing environment, and how that has affected the oud's history and place in Arabic music, world music?
I think it's interesting to reflect on the relationships between players and luthiers. And sometimes luthiers are themselves players. And sometimes there are close relationships built where a player particularly wants something new. And when they work with someone that knows how to do that, then there can be a very nice alchemy between them, and something really new and interesting emerges. As I narrate in my book, it seems to have been a very kind of modernist moment and a time of transformation in Iraq, when the oud player called Munir Bashir, who was the younger brother of Jamil Bashir, started to try to build his career outside Iraq, and his instrument broke, so that the face broke because the tension caused by the strings was too much. And the part that it's called the bridge, which was fixed to the front of the oud and enables you to tie the strings there, snapped right off. And it seems that when he got home to Baghdad with this broken oud, he went to the maker, and they came up with a new model, which was the one of putting the strings, attaching the strings to the actual body of the oud directly, and allowing the bridge to be mobile and to be positioned in the ideal place, but also to be conducting the sound in a very different way. And this was just, it's by chance that this development between Bashir and Mohammed Fadl, the luthier, coincided with a moment when Europeans were doing a kind of encyclopedic investigation of musics of the world. And they wanted a group of them in France and Switzerland. They were looking for somebody that could somehow give them the sound of the Arab world for their collection. rather like Ravi Shankar had done for right. India. They mm-hmm. thought these things are terribly simplistic and rather shameful. But Munir Bashir was the one that they found, and they were able to construct a legend, I would say, that went right back to medieval Iraq and mystify somewhat this extraordinarily modern innovation. And it was an enormous hit in Europe. And Munir Bashir became really the most influential oud player of the 20th century. Many people heard these recordings and were drawn to the oud, even though what they were hearing was some kind of Iraqi melodies played in a very unusual way. they felt called to this and themselves picked up the oud. And then There was a sort of culture war, I would say, in Oud communities between people that preferred still the fixed bridge, as we call it, the traditional way of attaching the strings to the Oud, and those that embraced the floating bridge, and very outspoken, sort of, that's not an Oud, it's a mandolin, kind of attitudes. And there were others that noticed that it was kind of sturdy, and you could play super loud, and you could tighten the strings. So it has less fragility. So it's kind of useful for the spaces in which people want to play Oud. And yes, it's now in Egypt, and throughout the Beit al-Oud Oud schools, it's played as a kind of standard. People don't necessarily know that, you know, they don't know this story, that actually they're playing, you know, where the floating bridge comes from and why it is novel. And why they might want to think about trying other models as well.
right.
So it's become a norm. Yeah, it's a sort of slightly kind of industrial model that is now.
Yeah, it's an invented tradition also, if it's being taught in these. So this is our Oud playing and this is Oud music. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting. Well, that's, you alluded there in that also to European encounters with an involvement in the more modern period. And in fact, you document also that the earliest surviving Ouds that we have are ones that are kept in museums in the West. And so there's a history of collection and characterization that maybe fits a little bit into your previous interests about Orientalism, and that have motivated some of your work to kind of respond to some of the characterizations of Arabic music, and with it, Arabic and Islamic cultures. How would you characterize the kind of role or involvement of colonial era European encounter with the Oud, its collection, and how that has affected the Oud, if it has? Well, you mentioned one way in which it had more recently, but are there other ways that you think are interesting to think about the legacy of colonialism in the Middle East and its effect on the Oud and its history?
Well, it's that very contradictory sense one has as a historian, recognizing that we benefit from colonial pillage. Because we can talk about things that otherwise would have been completely destroyed. So it is a result of European colonialism that we can see an Oud that was brought to Europe in 1839, and that is held in the Museum of Musical Instruments in Brussels. Without European colonialism, perhaps we wouldn't have such an early instrument to study. On the other hand, without European colonialism, perhaps that instrument would have stayed in Egypt and would still be there. You know, the kind of the pillage, the wreck that was caused in the Middle East, and the disruption, the types of division haven't created any stable spaces for the preservation of traditions. On the other hand, these are not cultures generally in the Arab world where preservation of the past has been particularly valued. But then, yeah, colonialism triggers a defense and a recognition that one's own tradition is being lost. And so there's a certain resistance. So often the Oud may be taken as a symbol of resistance to Western influence. Certainly, this was something that I struggled with as a British person, as I realized gradually I was being drawn to actually play the Oud, but I didn't really feel entitled to play it, because that might feel like a type of cultural appropriation. So I had a lot of anxieties about cultural appropriation. I tend to think these are women's anxieties, and that many men would just feel, no, that we are representing their culture, or we are spreading the word about their culture, and we're doing a good job. Whereas I felt, you know, ashamed to be wanting to do this. And it's taken me a long time to get over that. And also I didn't grow up hearing this music. It is new for me. I bring all the music in myself that I grew up with and have studied over decades, so that my playing and my interests in musical expression and the instrument aren't authentic in a sense, you know, that what I can give is something else. And I've had a lot of anxieties about whether that's problematic given the power struggles and the hideous imbalances of power that we live with today. Yeah, so there isn't a simple answer to that, mm-hmm. I'm afraid.
Well, no, that's very interesting, your reflections on it, both historically and personally in encountering the oud. You mentioned some of these kind of cross-cultural negotiations from a personal standpoint. And the book does such a great job of talking about some of the, what we might think of as marginal traditions in places of encounter, not in the Arab Middle East, but in a sort of regions around it. Everything from Greek and Armenian kind of interest in it, talking also about transformations more recently in the Gulf. But one that I thought was interesting and that kind of connects with this broader theme that we've been talking about reception of the oud in the West. You mentioned Munir Bashir's important and influential work and recordings. Somebody like Hamza El-Din, who represents also a kind of marginal cultural location within the Arabo-Islamic world as a Nubian in Upper Egypt, Northern Sudan, and the fact that his music actually is one of the, maybe in the second half of the 20th century, is one of the early experiences that people in the West had with the oud. If they didn't hear about it through, you know, Munir Bashir, maybe at the Newport Folk Festival in the 60s and the aftermath of two early recordings, Music of Nubia and The Oud, that represented kind of a unique sound, I take it, but I would like to have your thoughts on it. It's how I came to hear about the oud, you know, as a teenager, is through Hamza El-Din's music, which was utterly captivating, and is the sound that now, as I'm engaging with the oud, I realize isn't exactly like the sound of a lot of other oud playing. It's a kind of unique kind of tradition. So what does music like his kind of represent as the broader theme of the cultural history of the oud for you, as a way to kind of conclude our discussion with a more modern oud player who's a unique figure that maybe stands outside of the rest of this tradition?
As you say, he does seem to stand outside, in that the tradition, since that amazing moment when he played at the Newport Folk Festival in 1964 and then was kind of captured and taken up and given opportunities, it has been increasingly kind of dominated by a virtuoso line. So Hamza El-Din was a deeply expressive singer and oud player who communicated something, I think, in ways that weren't intended to sort of impress the audience in a flashy sense. You know, there was a message there. Mm-hmm. Whereas, yes, these days there's much more about showmanship. And I think another thing to say is that his unique sound is partly his playing and the tradition that he is using, but it's also that he plays a remarkable oud, which is one of the historical instruments made by the Al-Nahat family, so which is perhaps the most celebrated dynasty of luthiers from Syria. So that's another important point to make. I think just to balance, I would mention another marginal but crucial figure who's been in a kind of space of encounter more recently, and that's Camille Gibran. who is another singer, oud player, who also has a message, and her message is about Palestine. And she speaks to generally to a younger and more quirky audience, because her field is contemporary music. It's not traditional, except that she's playing with the oud. She's singing in Arabic, often traditional poetry, and she uses the rhythm of Arabic language. But she's another one that is really is saying something, yeah, in the space of encounter with difference.
Well, that's a wonderful note on which to conclude, especially when we think about what's happening in Palestine and to Palestinians at the moment that we're recording, to think about the varieties of oud and oud encounter, and how it can express not only the multiple cultures out of which it has emerged and responded to, but also contemporary conditions and the emotions and experiences of the peoples of the region and beyond. So I want to thank you so much, Rachel, for this fascinating, wonderful discussion, and even more for a beautiful and fantastic book that I want to encourage our listeners to go read. We scratched the surface. There's so much to learn about not only the oud as an instrument and its place in Arabic music and its fascinating story, but also as a way of appreciating and understanding a long history of musical culture and the history of this region and the regions to which it has been connected globally throughout history. It's called The Oud, An Illustrated History. It's published by Interlink Books. And again, thank you so much, Rachel, for coming on to the Mudjlis.
Thank you.
Listeners, I just want to leave you with another clip from Hamza El-Din, an excerpt from Oud Duo from his album Songs of the Nile. Enjoy it, and look out for another episode coming soon, later this month, when I talk to Dr. Nuri Ghana of UCLA about his new book about literature, film, and Arab intellectual culture in the post-1967 era. Until next time.
Thank you for joining us in the Mejlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Mejlis.